Roger Williams University is hosting a crisis management seminar on May 3rd at their Providence campus. Crises, whether a natural disaster, cyber attack, or financial instability, can have severe repercussions if not handled properly. This is where crisis management plays a pivotal role. Join Roger Williams MBA students and expert speakers to learn how to prepare for the unexpected. The program is totally free and open to the public. You can register online at rwu.edu/events/crisis-management-symposium.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Welcome to another edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Bartholomew. From our Providence, Rhode Island studios, I sit down with former United States Attorney and current candidate for Attorney General of Rhode Island, Peter Nerona. Peter Nerona is a native of Jamestown, Rhode Island. Though currently running unopposed, Mr. Nerona presents an in-depth platform on issues ranging from gun safety to corruption to environmental protections. Our conversation touched on Peter's vision for Rhode Island's future, navigating the current election season, and his time spent with former President Barack Obama. We're here with Peter Nerona on a beautiful day in Elmwood at the Lofts. Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for making the time. Appreciate it very much.
No, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah. If you don't mind, just give the listeners kind of a background of your work and kind of your life's journey so far.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a native Rhode Islander. I was born and raised in Jamestown. I'm actually a fourth-generation Jamestowner, Portuguese on my dad's side. My dad was born on the island, so go way back. My family worked on the ferries all those years and at the bridge. And then my mom's an immigrant from Germany. I went to North Kingston High School and graduated in the mid-'80s, went to Boston College. Boston College Law School. When I graduated from law school, joined a big Boston law firm, Goodwin Proctor, which, you know, then it had 300 lawyers, has 800 today. Really learned how to practice law, I think, at a pretty high level. It's a great training ground for young lawyers. But, you know, I had this urge to do two things: really get into a courtroom a little more than I've been doing, and also do some public service. So, in 1996, I moved back to Rhode Island. Had met my wife in Boston. We moved back here Memorial Day weekend, actually, in 1995. So, 23 years ago this weekend, and I started working in the AG's office, Attorney General's office. Jeff Pine, later Sheldon Whitehouse, kept me on. I spent 7 years there. Meanwhile, my wife and I had two kids, two boys. In 2002, I went over to the U.S. Attorney's office as an assistant U.S. attorney. In 2009, Senators Reid and Whitehouse recommended me to President Obama to be the U.S. attorney for the District of Rhode Island. I served in the Obama administration until I stepped down in March of 17, yes. And then and now I'm running for attorney general for the state of Rhode Island.
And you've got a platform that's pretty clear about, you know, the work you've done and where you want to take the state of Rhode Island. What would you say is your kind of priority, you know, generally speaking?
Sure.
You
know, So one of the reasons I'm running is I felt like the work we were doing when I was U.S. attorney is largely unfinished. There's a lot more work to do in the areas I thought were important to the people of the state of Rhode Island. You know, one of them is public corruption. And I always start there simply because, you know, we did so many public corruption cases when I was U.S. attorney. We prosecuted the three North Providence town councils for taking bribes. We prosecuted Mayor Moreau for taking bribes. We prosecuted Speaker of the House Gordon Fox on a public corruption case. We prosecuted House Financier Ray Gallison as well. And so I expect that work will continue. I wish that it were not going to be the case, but I think that it is. And I think it's really critically important that our public officials do the right thing. The vast majority of them do, but there are some that don't. And when they don't, not only is it wrong simply because when you're a public official and you swear an oath to serve the people, you ought to do that because that's what you've committed yourself to doing, but I'm absolutely convinced it has a negative impact on our economy. Nobody wants to do business in a state that's for sale, right, or has a reputation for being for sale. And so if we don't change that reputation, if we don't stay on top of those cases, my sons, who are nearing adulthood, I'd like them to come back if that's what they want to do. If we don't have an economy that that provides jobs for all of our residents because businesses don't want to do here, do business here. That's bad for all of us. So that's got to be a priority. What else? This opioid crisis that we're facing. You know, we're losing between 300 and 350 Rhode Islanders every single year to opioid overdose. When I was U.S. attorney, you know, we did lots of big cartel-related drug trafficking cases, and we need to continue to do that work on the federal and the state side. But we've got to do more than that. We've got to use the bully pulpit of the office as AG, as I did as U.S. attorney, to reach people, particularly kids. When I was U.S. attorney, I made 28 visits to high schools in that last year. In fact, I did a lot of them after I'd stepped down. And the reason I did them was I wanted to talk to kids about making smart choices. You know, I would walk into those auditoriums around the state, everywhere from Woonsocket to Newport to Providence, Central Falls, Barrington, Bristol, you name it. When I asked kids, do you know what an opioid is? Not a lot of hands went up, but I asked them what a Vicodin was or what a Percocet is or what an OxyContin is. Every hand went up. If I asked them, how many of you have had your wisdom teeth out or know someone who did or had a sibling who did, every hand went up, right? And the connection between these pills and heroin and fentanyl-laced heroin, which is what's killing people so quickly, is incredibly close. And those pills are in medicine cabinets around the state. And worse than that, we were finding just as in the last couple of years as I was leaving office, that drug dealers were taking fentanyl and pressing it into pills that look like Oxy. So I would say to the kids, if someone hands you a pill, it's bad enough that if it's a legitimate pill, right? But if it's a fake pill, that can kill you almost instantly. And I would say to them, look around this auditorium and imagine everyone in this auditorium being dead this year just in Rhode Island from overdose. So we've got to continue as people who have that bully pulpit, who have that ability to reach people, to talk to kids about making smart choices. And the other thing we did around the opioid crisis was, and I think this is work that has to continue, is we did town halls around the state at night where I would moderate a panel of people who do treatment work, who do substance abuse counseling, medical experts from the Department of Health and elsewhere, to talk to adults about raising awareness around the problem. And as time went on, so many adults with adult children would get up and say, look, I'm really worried about a child. I can't get treatment. Or we can't get them treatment, or we can't keep them in treatment, or we can't afford treatment. And so, again, you got to use the bully pulpit of the office to advocate for affordable and accessible treatment. Another priority is the criminal justice system. We've got to have a criminal justice system that's smart in how we take on crime. In the Obama administration, we really focused on what we called a Smart on Crime program, which was on the enforcement side, identifying and targeting those people who truly drive violent crime. And by that, I mean people who shoot, frankly, other people. They're the ones who drive crime. They pull a lot of other, particularly young people, into their orbit. They've got to be the focus of our law enforcement efforts. At the same time, we've got to understand that young people who are sort of at that tipping point, some that have already tipped a little bit into contact with the criminal justice system, they can be saved, brought back, if we invest the resources in getting them straightened out. And I don't think straightening them out means sending a nonviolent offender to prison for 30 days or 60 days or 6 months. I'm a big believer in diversion programs. People that we can get turned around, we've got to get turned around. And on the other side of it, when people are getting out of prison, I talk about this a lot. There's only 30 guys that aren't coming home from the ACI. Of the couple thousand or more guys out there and women out there, all but 30 are coming home. So when they come home, what happens? I'm convinced that if we don't get them back into the workforce, they're going to reoffend, which means we have another victim, so we have another crime. We have to send them back to the ACI at tremendous expense to the taxpayer. So I've often thought of it this way. If you want to make a prosecutor pay attention to criminal justice reform and being smart about who we're prosecuting and for how long, if we're recommending incarceration, put the prison budget in the prosecutor's budget the way it is in the Department of Justice when I was there, and you'll make prosecutors pay attention. So I think taking that kind of holistic approach to a criminal justice system engenders trust in it, faith in it, and it makes a lot of sense across a lot of layers. I think the other priorities are largely in the civil division. There's a lot of work that the civil division in the AG's office does. There's a lot of civil work I did when we were U.S. attorney with the team that I had. And I think it's work that in the Trump administration is unlikely to continue in two specific areas. One is around the environment. I think after the state's people, our greatest asset is our environment here in Rhode Island. We need to protect it. I don't think that this administration values environmental protection very highly. So I think AGs around the country, including in Rhode Island, really need to step up and do environmental enforcement. We did a lot of that work when I was U.S. attorney. I think that work has to continue. And I think civil rights work really has to be something that AGs continue to prioritize. Because, again, I don't think that this administration that we have now will be as robust in that area as we were in the Obama administration. And it's not just civil rights in the context of excessive use of force by police officers, which happens in a very few instances, is important, and we need to focus on that. But things like access to voting, access to housing, you know, fighting housing discrimination. Those are basic fundamental rights that all Rhode Islanders have, and AGs need to be there to step up when those rights are being violated. So, you know, there's lots of other things we can do to protect Rhode Islanders. Issues around cybersecurity, really important. Things around consumers, right? We've got to reach consumers to protect them from the scams that we have out there. Elder abuse, another really important subject area. So there's a lot in that portfolio, but those are some of the things that when someone asks me what needs to be at the top of the thinking, those are some of the things.
I've heard a lot about a lot of questions from listeners as well to or feedback from listeners about guns and how we proceed, especially with related to school shootings.
Sure.
Where do you stand in just a blanket sense on the issues of guns?
Yeah. So I think gun safety is obviously critically important. I have, you know, have had two kids go through school. I have one who's going to graduate from my youngest is going to graduate as a senior in high school. So all of my thinking about guns is actually on the website. So if anybody's interested in actually seeing it, peternarner.com, issues, gun safety. So I think there's a lot that we can do to improve issues around safety in schools and elsewhere. Some of those things we ought to be able to agree on. So, for example, we ought to be able to agree on universal background checks. Makes no sense to me that you have to do a full background check if you buy a gun from a federally licensed firearms dealer, but not from somebody at a gun show or who's doing a private sale. So nationally, we ought to have universal background checks. I believe in red flag legislation, both in Rhode Island and across the country. You know, people for whom there are warning signs about the potential harm to others and to themselves, right? Suicide's a big part of this discussion, too, right? I believe in legislation to kind of get guns out of their hands for a period of time. Let's see exactly where they are. I believe in that legislation.
You think it'll hold up in spite of ACLU challenges and everything,
do
you think it'll go through?
I do, yeah. As long as the due process protections are built into the statutes. And look, Connecticut's had a statute for almost 20 years that's withstood scrutiny. Rhode Island's will be newer if it gets passed by both houses and the governor signs it, but it'll withstand due process scrutiny. As long as there's a hearing, so the person whose guns are being seized has an opportunity to contest the seizure, has a chance to come back and appeal it. I think as long as we build in those due process protections, it'll withstand constitutional scrutiny, and we should have those due process protections the way we do in lots of other areas. So I think that's good legislation. I'm in favor of only allowing police officers or school resource officers to carry in schools. Look, police officers are trained to handle firearms. They go through mental health checks annually. I think that's important for everyone who's sort of carrying, particularly police officers, particularly in schools. You know, I don't like the idea of a teacher being armed. Many of them don't want to do it, but also if law enforcement's going into a school, how do they know who the perpetrator is? If a teacher is carrying a firearm and, you know, obviously doesn't have a sweatshirt or a jacket that says, look, I'm a teacher, I'm the one who's okay, right? How do they know who the real threat is? So I'm not in favor of arming anyone other than a trained police officer in a school. In terms of high-capacity magazines, I'm in favor of legislation which would limit them. You know, I think every second we save, you know, I talk to people who are against that position, and I respect their views, and I respect the Second Amendment. But if we can save even the 1, 2, or 3 seconds it takes for someone to change a magazine, if that saves one child's life, it's worth it to me to have that legislation. And I am in favor of a ban, which would only go forward because all of the assault-like weapon bans or weapons like AR-15s bans that we're talking about are only going in the future. So it's not going to take any guns off the street. That's why I don't think it's a panacea to the problem that we're facing. But I am in favor of that as well. And we had one when I was an assistant U.S. attorney federally. You know, I know people differ about its effect, but I didn't feel like we had any trouble enforcing it, frankly. And I think, again, if the balance is this is a weapon where police who are responding to these incidents are outgunned, right, if the round that's typically used, not always, but typically used in that firearm or that kind of firearm causes tremendous damage to someone who's shot by it, then again, if I'm making a choice between protecting children, between protecting adults, then that's a choice that I'm prepared to make. And I know that they're used in the, you know, if you look at the gun deaths across the country, that those kinds of weapons are used in a very small number of deaths, but they do seem to be the weapon of choice for these school shootings in particular. And so when I weigh those things in the balance, that's where I come out on those issues.
Yeah, it's such a, you know, an emotional issue mm-hmm. that you sometimes wonder if we could all just, every person could just sit down for, you know, 3 days and hammer something out, you know, somehow, but we've been at it for decades now. And
yeah, and I think
years.
Yeah, I think, well, I think there are some things where we ought to be able to agree in the middle. So, you know, like on the website, you know, when I talk about these issues, I say, look, this is what I think. Do I think we're likely to reach agreement on all? I think I have 10 things on there. I just mentioned some of them. Do I think we're likely to reach agreement on all 10? Probably not. But we ought to be able to agree on some things in the middle. We can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. You know, all of us should advocate for our positions, and I advocate strongly for the ones that I hold. But we ought to be able to agree on something. And we shouldn't let our divisions at the margins prevent us from getting to some sort of agreement in the middle. And I will tell you, I've had lots of conversations with people who are probably on the other side of this issue generally from me. We've had good, respectful conversations back and forth. And so, you know, I have some optimism there in the long run.
Yeah, I think so. And leadership as well. I met Frank Sykosian mm-hmm. and some of these guys that I went to one of their rallies.
Yeah.
And when you speak with them, you know, they're reasonable people.
Sure.
They have similar long-term goals, I would
right.
say, as your position or whatever,
right.
frankly, is mine as well.
Right.
But yeah, it's gotten so emotional and so much Facebook you
right.
know, memeing about it that it's
right.
basically almost seemed to have lost the essence of the debate at this
right.
point. Rhode Island's interesting right now. It kind of a nationwide phenomenon, but we're seeing a progressive mm-hmm. wing of the Democratic Party
right.
emerge in the gubernatorial race. We have Matt Brown mm-hmm. and even Paul Roselli's in there. Obviously, Aaron Raitt, Representative Regenberg
right.
in the lieutenant gubernatorial race. And in to a certain extent, Lincoln Chafee, Governor
right.
Chafee, throwing
right.
his name
right.
into the
right.
ring.
Right.
So what's going on? Do you think as AG you'd be able to, if some of these state offices did mm-hmm. change hands to a more progressive platform, do you think as AG you'd be able to broker, you know, kind of be the center point of reason in the state if it gets pulled, so, you know, where it would almost
right.
seem like they would be so extreme that it would be difficult to work?
Yeah. You know, I can only draw on my experience as U.S. attorney, you know, and leading that office for, gosh, almost 8 years and having a lot of constituencies to deal with just within the law enforcement community, let alone beyond it in Rhode Island, where, you know, in a perfect world, all law enforcement would be on the same page all the time. We weren't always. And so a lot of the job as U.S. attorney was, you know, getting people in a room, getting them to work together, not just law enforcement, on other issues like prisoner reentry, same kind of a thing. You know, again, that bully pulpit function we're talking about. You know, I like to think that my experience has helped develop some of these skills. I also think that, you know, I think we can agree to disagree about issues and at the same time still find ways to work together on the things we do agree with. I mean, one thing I learned, you know, when I was U.S. attorney is that even if I disagreed with somebody on a particular issue, whether it be case related or a way of looking at the world, let's say, we still were able to find common ground, right? You know, some of it was around the opioid crisis. You know, as prosecutors, we have a lot of discretion. And sometimes, you know, the way we exercise that discretion, not everyone always agreed with it, right? But we were still able to pull together and put on a pill summit, for example, around responsible prescribing, on prisoner reentry, right? Sort of working with sometimes members of the defense bars, probation and parole, able to put together a great summit for employers on hiring people getting out of the prison. Not a likely place to find a prosecutor putting such a thing on, but mm-hmm. we were able to work in that space, right? And because I thought it was important. A lot of the child sex trafficking work that we did involved a lot of other partners, some sort of unusual combinations of people to get to a good result. So, you know, when the elections are over and the people of Rhode Island have chosen who they want their leaders to be, you know, regardless of party, you know, we ought to be able to come together and move the state forward in a way that's good for everybody. So I'm confident that if I'm fortunate enough to get elected, I could help in that area.
Are you in favor of offshore drilling in federal waters and expanding wind farms and and kind of looking to the future in that arena?
Yeah, so I'm not in favor of offshore drilling. But in terms of energy, I think one of the things that I've found as I've been out and about, and it could be, we could be talking about healthcare, we could be talking about energy. I think one place where we as a state could do better is in strategic thinking around some of these issues, right? So we tend to look at, whether it be healthcare or energy or some of these other issues, you know, we look at things on a transactional basis. We look at it from a very narrow focus, right? Do we think that this project is a good one or a bad one, right? So when we're talking about renewables, right? We ought to be looking at renewables in the context of our overall energy plan. It ought to include hydro and gas and renewables, solar, and within renewables, solar, wind. And where are we putting them? How much do we need? We know nuclear's coming offline. We know we're probably going to get gains in efficiency going forward. So what's our strategic thinking around those areas, right? Another one's come up recently, this biomass plant that kind of sort of appeared out of nowhere in the last week or so. And I haven't studied that closely. I have to admit that sort of burning anything sort of makes me think, should we be doing this, right? But where does that fit in our overall energy strategy that ought to be emphasizing our environment, protecting our environment, at the same time delivering the energy that we need for not only the immediate term but the long term? Same thing about healthcare, right? We look at healthcare in the context of individual transactions, and I understand why that's important, but we ought to be thinking about healthcare much more holistically. How accessible is it? How effective is it? How affordable is it, right? And everything that we do in healthcare ought to be looked at by looking through those three, the lens of those three things, right? So I try to look at, regardless of what the issue is, I try to look at it strategically. I sort of have learned that in the 20 years I've been doing law enforcement, that you look at everything through a strategic lens, and you've got to make better decisions if you do it that way.
It's very interesting. Yeah, so the broad stroke doesn't necessarily apply. It's interesting with the wind turbines in particular. It's become somewhat of an environmental issue with birds and whales and things of this sort. That's
fishing.
Why, and fisheries as well, absolutely. So that's why it kind of somewhat gets grouped to me with offshore drilling, because there is a consequence. Of course, the flip side, if you look at Block Island, you know, it's kind of obvious that it's a more sustainable way to generate energy. But you're in favor of exploring wind and hydro and
sure, and absolutely. So for example, if I know there's for those of your listeners who follow what's been going on in Massachusetts, there's been a tremendous debate around hydro there, right? Getting it down from Canada, getting it through the pristine forests of New Hampshire, getting it through Maine or Vermont, however they do it.
Native territories as well.
So there's a lot of issues that go into this. But if it's going to get here somehow in a way that is environmentally sound and respects Native peoples, then where does Rhode Island fit into that, right? They're one state away. How do we make that work? You know, you can go over, you know, I had to take one of my sons out to Bristol the other day, going over the Mount Hope Bridge, and you can't help but not look at Brayton Point.
Yeah, and Somerset and the
and look at those reactors. And look at the towers, and you know that it's mothballed, and think, where did that fit in our strategy? I know why we needed those cooling towers, because of the heated water going back into the bay.
Yep.
But when we were thinking about that facility, where were we thinking that in terms of the long-term strategic planning? I think we have to do that. My understanding is that in healthcare, the last strategic plan that we have for statewide is in writing. It covers 1988 to 1992, I think. So there's work to be done here. And a lot of players want to do that work. It's really a matter of getting people around the table, putting sort of individualized interests, checking them at the door and thinking about what's best for the state of Rhode Island, the people of the state of Rhode Island, around those three areas I mentioned a moment ago.
Right. We've got telemedicine and all kinds of ways to approach community health now that certainly since 1992, it's definitely changed. Yeah.
Sure. You know, going to the ER, my wife's a primary care doctor, right? Mm-hmm. Delivering health care in the ER is expensive. It's not your doctor many times, right? And the wait times are long. That's not good for anybody. Now, some people need the ER, obviously, if it's a trauma issue. Mm-hmm. But to go in there for a sore throat doesn't make a lot of sense. So if doctors are able to adjust their schedules to see patients on Saturdays or Sundays, on a 365-day-a-year basis, that's good for the patient. They're seeing doctors who have access to their medical records. They don't have to wait as long. They can get an appointment. Keeps them out of the ER. Keeps costs down, right? So, you know, that's strategic. Just one small example of strategic healthcare thinking that ought to be the kind of things that we're doing.
That's very interesting. You're currently running unopposed. Is that correct?
As of today, I don't have an opponent, no.
Do you feel, what do you think's the the secret mission here coming? Is there something coming up the, you know, down the line here?
Yeah, I've really tried to focus from the beginning. I announced last October, and I've really tried to focus on a couple things. One is my own thinking around these issues. You know, you can pick up the newspaper, the Journal, Promise Journal, pick up a national outlet, and see 5 new issues a day. Yesterday, I opened the Journal, and there were 5 new issues. And I did some media in Woonsocket yesterday morning. Wow, there's 5 things that could come up today. I need to stay up to speed on this. So part of what I've been focused on over the last 6-7 months has been making sure that the issues that I already know something about, I keep on top of, and then educate myself around the things that I don't know as much about. The other thing is trying to meet as many Rhode Islanders as I can, talk to them about the things that are important to me and I hope are important to them, and hearing from them about the things that I don't know are important to them. And so I haven't focused as much on sort of, you know, other potential candidates. I've tried to do my thing. And then, you know, as the race develops over the next few months, see how things go.
That's very interesting. There's a specific issue in Narragansett. I won't put you on the spot, but as I understand, the Rhode Island Constitution allows us to, as Rhode Islanders, to access the beach or any shoreline. Mm-hmm. Narragansett charges, they've always charged something to get on the beach as far back as I can remember going there, $5, $10. Now they have this $200 per person fee for all non-residents to access the beach. So there's a lot of tension already building up in the surf communities, and also particularly in South Kingstown, North Kingstown, Charlestown, who you know, basically see themselves as one area. You know, I mean, what's your take on just shoreline access? Obviously, I wouldn't put you on the spot to comment on that issue, but just in general, shoreline access, natural resource access, and
One of the great differences between, you know, I was a resident in Massachusetts for about 7 years between college and when Shelley and I moved back here, and that's one of the great differences between Massachusetts and Rhode Island, right? Rhode Island has much greater protection to the public for the shoreline. I'll get this wrong if I try to do this. I'm going to take a stab at it anyway. In Massachusetts, you can walk the shore below the mean low tide, I think. So you basically have to be in the water to walk the shore if you don't own the property in front of it. In Massachusetts and Rhode Island, we have a very different approach, right? Where you can walk on that exposed shoreline, right? Yeah. So I think that's great. I think, you know, again, our environment after our people is our number one asset, and that should be for everybody. You know, my little hometown of Jamestown, you know, has a public beach. Residents can get a sticker. I mean, you may be able to get a sticker. I don't think you can get an annual sticker if you don't live there, but it's open to everybody, right? Parking can be a challenge, but we make do, right? We figure out ways to accommodate everybody. I think that's what we ought to be doing. We ought to make sure, you know, we ought to respect communities and their ability to sort of protect their assets for their residents, right? I get that. That's why in Jamestown, if you're a resident, you can get a sticker. But we ought to make sure that there are opportunities through our state beaches and other ways to make sure that everybody in Rhode Island, whatever their means, wherever they live, have access to one of our greatest assets.
Yeah, I would agree completely. I mean, it just seems like one of the most important parts of being a Rhode Islander is having that access to the woods or to the city or whatever. You know,
one of the great programs, and I think this is great, that the Institute for the Study and Practice of Nonviolence has done in the past. I don't know if they're still doing it, but they take kids from Providence, right, who may not see the ocean all that much, or if they see it, they see a sliver of it, sort of at the Upper Bay, and they take them to Narragansett Beach, I think, or Scarborough or somewhere down there, and they teach them to surf. But in some instances, they may even teach them to swim. I'm not sure. But it's great, right? You know, I'm amazed. You know, I spoke at I can't remember which high school it was. I know where it is. It's right off of Thurber's Avenue. I spoke at a Providence high school when I was still a U.S. attorney. I sat and I talked to the kids before I spoke to them. It was prom night, so getting them to pay attention was difficult, I can tell you. So I talked to them a little bit before I got up and gave my general remarks. And I was explaining them where I'm from. And, you know, there's some kids from Providence. You know, for them, Jamestown may be on the other side of the planet.
Right.
So it's really important that not only do we have access for everybody, but we make it possible and we encourage Rhode Islanders who may not necessarily have the ability to get to some of these places to get there. It's why the bus service is important. It's why some of the work that that Providence is doing, the Providence After School Alliance, I think, also does something like this. Let's get everybody in our state an opportunity to see what is one of our greatest assets.
Most definitely. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see where public transit goes as well. I've heard some a proposition for a monorail that goes downtown or whatever it is, but it certainly is an inconvenience at this point, you know, for most people to navigate the state.
Well, it is. And it's important, you know, and one of the things, you know, when I was U.S. attorney, again, I alluded to it earlier, we really worked hard. I wrote one op-ed on this subject, actually. The only op-ed I ever wrote was about getting people getting out of prison back into the workforce. And one of the challenges for those people, as it is for many other people, is getting to the jobs, right? If RIPTA doesn't go all the way into Quonset Office Park, as when I was still U.S. attorney, it didn't do, right? Right. But there are businesses that will hire, right, whether you're coming out of the prison or not. That doesn't make a lot of sense, right? So we've got to make sure that our public transportation system is funded adequately enough that it can get people to jobs and to things like the beach.
Absolutely. As U.S. attorney, did you ever spend any time with President Obama in person?
I did. Yeah.
What's he like as a... Yeah. As a human, what's that moment like?
You know, I found him to be very... at ease with himself, you know, and we met with him a couple of times. There were only 93 of us. We were all of his appointees. We were all pulled together in the same direction as part of the Department of Justice. So he met with us at least two, maybe three times at the White House, not for long periods of time, but spoke to us, had a very easy way about him. You know, spoke to us directly about what his expectations were. And I think this is important. And I remember these words like they were yesterday. The first time he met us, we were in the East Room, you know, collectively waiting for him to come in. We had a picture taken. He said to us when he walked in, he said, "I appointed you, but you don't serve me. You serve the American people. And I expect you to act independently and with good judgment." And I have always remembered those words because they captured the mission of what the Justice Department ought to be. And I think that's particularly important today, right, that the department has to be independent. And even though we were appointed by the president, we didn't swear an oath to President Obama. When I took that oath here in Providence, I took it to the Constitution of the United States, right, to serve the people of the United States. And so that's what I remember about the president. I remember those words, and I remember the easy sort of genuineness that he had about himself. My sense was that he liked people. He liked being with us, good memories.
Quite an experience.
It was, to say the least. It was a great ride.
What's your relationship like with Senator Whitehouse? Do you have a relationship with him at all at this point?
Yeah, so, you know, he was my boss when I was in the AG's office for part of my time there. Jeff Pine, you know, as I said, hired me. So I didn't have a ton of contact with Sheldon then, other than in that sort of attorney general, you know, assistant attorney general relationship. You know, certainly he played a big role in recommending me to President Obama, along with Senator Reid. You know, from time to time, I would bump into him when I was U.S. attorney, although, you know, Congress being a different constitutional branch, you know, we did not see each other a lot. You know, so now that I'm running for attorney general and he is running for U.S. Senate, you know, I do see him occasionally, and we have a good relationship, as I had with Senator Reid. You know, I always found Senator Reid, you know, really to have a great, how do I put this, really brought sort of solid, sober thinking to many difficult issues from a real rational point of view, which maybe because I've been a lawyer, you know, really for all of my adult life, that it's kind of the way I try to approach issues, sort of analytically. Let's think about what makes sense here. Let's see if we can rally around together to get to a result that will work for as many people as possible.
Yeah, he does seem like the wise man, you know, sort of the default guru in a way.
Absolutely. You know,
I bumped into him when I was in like high school, and it was one of those bars in Narragansett on the water, and he was just sitting there by himself, staring out, looking at the ocean, wearing a polo shirt, you know, just kind of incognito. And I just kind of give him a head nod. I was like, "I'm going to let you have this moment because this is as real as it gets."
Indeed.
Last question: Rhode Island is facing a homelessness crisis. Mm-hmm. I would say I just moved to Providence in January, so a few months here now, and I can't help but see as I drive around sort of a level of desperation that I didn't really encounter in New York, except for in the thick of the fake marijuana crisis.
Right,
you know, that I did see similar behaviors, but what's going on here? I'm trying to figure it out. I've been interviewing people, asking, you know, trying to help as I can, you know, but it seems like there's a systemic problem here that doesn't seem to be getting any better.
You know? Yeah, you know, look, I think I don't have the answers, and it's far beyond my area of expertise. But let me say this. I see what you see. I've seen it with my children as I've sort of driven around Rhode Island, and you see it not just in Providence. You see it You see it in Cranston. You see it in Newport. There is, and it's sad, right? It really does tug at you, and you're not sure how to help, right, in a direct way. You know how to help institutionally by supporting organizations that do great work in this area. You know, certainly there's a mental health component to this, right, that many people struggling with homelessness struggle with mental health issues. So that's a place to start. I think we have to make sure that, you know, that we have that people have access to mental health counseling. But part of it, too, is somehow reaching people who have the right to not want it, right? It's a complicated thing, and I've personally struggled with it, right? You want to help the person you run into on a street corner, and yet you don't know that if you're helping, whether it's directly, whether it's the right thing to do or not. And I often sometimes, and I'll just share this, I've often, when I've been confronted with that on an individual basis, I've often thought, you know, sort of what I do versus this person is between me and whatever higher power I believe in, and what that person does with whatever help I give is between them and theirs. But it is heart-rending. I've seen it in D.C. I was there for a conference, and, you know, what the situations that I run into where it's a parent with a child, right, who is asking for assistance on the street, and you wonder, you know, I'm certainly concerned about the adult, but I'm more concerned about the child, right? What is that child's life like? I don't have any easy answers. I think it's great that you bring it up. I think it's great that we talk about it. I think it's great that leaders, know that it's something that's important and we need to focus on. We've got to dedicate resources to it. It's sort of like, to me, it's similar in a sense to, we've done a lot of work, good work around criminal justice reform. But if we don't invest in probation and parole, the people that when people get off probation or while they're on probation, when they are paroled, if we don't invest there, our outcomes are not going to be good, right? If we don't invest in making mental health counseling and shelter and access to housing, if we don't invest there, then these problems are going to continue to replicate themselves. I know that one of the challenges is that the shelters, including the one at Harrington Hall, on the grounds of the ACI, can't stay there during the day. So, you know, you can shelter there at night, but during the day, you have to leave. So where does someone go? Where do they go to maybe get their lives back on track? Thorny problems for sure, but important ones. It's good that you raised them.
It's apparent you're a person who loves the law, you know, and uses it, you know, to try to better the world. You know, is that a fair statement?
Well, look, you know, I love public service. You know, I've only had one client since I've been back in the state of Rhode Island, which is the people of the state. And it sounds a little trite, but I will tell you that I represented, you know, institutional clients when I was in private practice, and I had student loans to pay off. I learned how to, you know, draft good documents and write well and think analytically. But I've loved serving the people of the state of Rhode Island. It's been a tremendous privilege for me to walk into courtrooms around the state and to stand up and say, you know, I'm representing the people of the state of Rhode Island. I'm representing the United States. I'm representing the state of Rhode Island. That's meant a lot to me. And I think there are lots of ways, you know, I've often thought about how to describe the Attorney General's office. And it really is the people's lawyer. That's how it ought to be looked at, right? That it should represent the common good. You know, if there's a situation where a state agency is not doing what it should, then it may not be the role of the AG to represent that state agency. It may be the role of the AG to make sure that agency is serving the public in the way that it should. It's a complicated, in many ways, legal question. But I thought of myself as an activist U.S. attorney. I like to think that if I'm fortunate enough to be elected as AG, I'd be an activist AG, which means where I saw a problem, I would do everything I could to try to help.
Well, best of luck to you.
Thank you.
You know, currently running unopposed. We'll see how that develops.
I could change in 10 minutes.
Yeah,
we'll see.
It's a long way to September. That's the wild thing about Rhode Island.
It is.
Candidate for Attorney General and former U.S. Attorney, Peter Norona. Thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Good to see
you.
Real
pleasure. Yep.
Hey, thanks for listening. Remember to subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite listening platform. You may also find us via the Newport Buzz or TuneIn Radio, Stitcher, and Google Play. Until next time, thanks for visiting Bartholomew Town. We'll talk soon.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits. and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.